From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Here we are in the Media Project, an opportunity for a half hour of commentary and analysis and maybe even some insight into the news media issues of the week. I like to say that because I think that it gives us some hopeful sign as the program gets underway. I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union, here with Dr. Alan Chartok, the CEO of Northeast Public Radio.
Yo, glad to be here, Rex.
Thank you. That's enough from you. Now we're on to Kaylin Brown, a professor from the College of St. Rose. How are you, Kaylin?
I am well. How are you?
Wonderful to see you, professor. And Judy Patrick, editor of the Daily Gazette in Schenectady. How are you?
I'm ever hopeful.
Ever hopeful. This is good. Yes. You know, fortune favors the bold, as they say. So we have a lot to talk about. And actually, I really liked this column by Brian Stelter of CNN, who wrote about journalism and activism. This arises from a conversation with the editor of the student newspaper at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School, who was asked about the demonstration that went on in Washington, of course, and in 800 cities elsewhere. And she was asked, I see a lot of Parkland students becoming activists, but you all were there as journalists, Brian Stelter of CNN said to her. Do you see a difference right now between journalism and activism in what you're doing? And here is what Rebecca Schneid said, one of the editors of the high school student newspaper. She said, I think that for me, the purpose of journalism is to raise the voices of people that maybe don't have a voice. And so I think that in its own right, journalism is a form of activism. She says she sees distinctions between the two, but I think that the partnership of the two is the only reason that we are able to make change. All right, class. Discuss.
From the mouths of babes, Rex, right? She is a very insightful young woman, and it's a beautiful thing to see that a young journalist is recognizing the connection and that in journalism we are agenda setters. And that when journalism makes a decision about what is going to get covered in the news, that is a form of activism.
What do you think, Judy?
I think there is a definite distinction, but I agree with Kaylin that we are fooling ourselves if we think that we're not setting agendas by the stories we choose to do. And, you know, when it comes time to consider what stories have been most successful, often we think, well, what resulted in change. This particular investigative piece resulted in significant change. But then again, you're hearing from journalists in our profession who say there is a complete distinction, and it should not be activism. We should just report the facts. I think that's an old-fashioned view.
Dr. Chartok, that might be your cue.
Well, you told me to shut up, so I was trying to do that.
Aw, Alan.
Nevertheless, I thought I was on board with Judy here, but it turns out I'm not, because you guys work under a certain kind of myth, which is that it's myth that we're going to cover it, you know, without being activists. But you are activists. Every time you decide what goes on the first front page and what headline that you're going to use and what stupid thing Trump said the day before that, you know, you point out, it is clear. You take a look at the two polls in New York City journalism. We've talked about this many times, Rex, but the New York Daily News and the New York Post, and they are both activists. The news just hates Trump, and is just every day it's, and by the way, I think the Times comes pretty close in its own elitist but good way, and then the Post is on the other side. You are looking at me, as Kaylin, as if I have, if I have two heads. Am I saying something wrong?
I would never dare say that, Alan. I'm just interested in what constitutes activism in journalism and what constitutes plain journalism. But I think the fact that journalism gets done in particular ways helps it to fall into the umbrella area of activism, even though journalists don't go into journalism generally saying, I'm an activist. They go in to have voices heard, the same way this editor at the Marjorie Stoneman newspaper was talking about, we want to give voice to the voiceless. That's what journalism has, the drum that it has beaten for a long, long time.
Well, I loved what you said. I agree with you. However, I have to say, if you hire an editor for a newspaper and they say, I hate the bastard, meaning Trump or anybody else, that's going to affect the way in which they make up their newspaper, isn't it?
Yes and no. Yeah. I think that it is entirely possible for an editor to say, I hate the bastard, but I don't let that affect the decisions that I make as an editor. I was intrigued by the response of the politics editor of the National Journal, Joss Kroschauer, who said that journalism isn't activism, it's presenting the facts honestly and objectively. And here's this point. He said, it's this mentality that is killing trust in our profession. You know, the problem is that there are an awful lot of people who aren't as sophisticated, I think that's the word that Kalen used, as this young student, Rebecca Schneid, who don't understand that when you're saying it is activism in the sense that you are making choices of topics and issues that you present, an awful lot of people really don't trust us. And so to the extent that we can present material
in the old-fashioned boring way.
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I think this young woman is right, but I understand why it is difficult for consumers of journalism to buy this notion.
How can you think she's right, Rex? I take great umbrage at that.
The young woman, I think she's right.
Yeah. How can you say that she's right when you consistently sat here week after week and pompously argued that you guys are playing it down the middle and that...
I don't say down the middle. I say we play it fair.
Okay, but...
The middle is not always fair.
Okay, if she says we give voice to the voiceless...
Yeah.
Isn't that a position that when we see something that we consider needing rectifying, people aren't getting enough money for their schools or people aren't getting enough money for their mental health or people aren't getting this or that,
right,
that we're going to advocate for them?
No.
Doesn't that mean it?
We write the story that presents the facts and lets the public decide.
You are kidding, Judy.
You know, the one thing I think we're activists for is for democracy. Or we might be activists for literacy. I think we like the idea of people being able to be literate and reading. But I think every editor would say, yes, in America at least, would say we are activists for the good functioning of democracy.
But you're kidding yourself, of course, Judy.
No, I am not.
Yeah, well, you are. And I'm gonna show you how. At least I'm going to try to. And I don't want to be accused of mansplaining, although sometimes people will say that as soon as you argue intellectually back and forth with another human being.
That was mansplaining. Go on. Let's hear it, Alan.
I like it. Okay. So the idea that you're making a representation for the voiceless and that you're going to do it because they can't do it means you got to be carrying somebody's water. It does. And if there's a Trumpster listening to this right now...
unlikely, given the market of WANC.
But they'll be ticked off at you, Judy, for that, because they're going to be saying, I'm not one, of course, because I happen to think it's correct to do that. But I don't like it when Fox does it, and I don't like it when the New York Post does it, and I don't like it when the Washington Examiner does it. And these people are taking a different view. So I'm simply saying to you, you're looking perplexed.
I'm still trying to understand your point.
Well, my point is that newspapers have attitudes, and they hire because of those attitudes, and that the New York Times editorial page, which I love, bleeds into the way in which the New York Times covers its stories.
So, Judy, how has your attitude as the editor of the Gazette affected your hiring? That's what Alan's basically saying, is that your hiring process is corrupt because your point of view is reflected in who you've hired.
It has nothing to do with my hiring practices. It has nothing to do with the stories we choose to cover. There are 1,000 stories for us to cover every day, and we do try to provide a mix of them. It has nothing to do. I'm looking for reporters who are inquisitive, hardworking, who care about the community, who care about people. We never talk politics.
Okay, so let's go back here for a second, Judy, if we can. I read a story as I was up in the middle of the night about how the New York Times is taking great credit for having achieved equality on its staff. In other words, that they have now as many women in editorial positions and in as many people of diverse color as the population reflects. When you hire that way, aren't you saying that women, for example, have a perspective, or that people of color have a perspective?
Yes, so yes. So that is to the point of your effort is to be fair, is to reflect the reality of society. That is value-laden, and the value is fairness. The value is accuracy, because a more diverse workforce will give you a more accurate news report. You know, the difficulty, too, with saying...
So why do you need to do it? In other words, if everybody's being fair, as Judy has indicated, why do you need to do it? Because you're being fair, so...
Oh, I see what your point is, that you wouldn't have to hire 51% of your staff women if the men were as fair in their reporting as we are suggesting.
Well, because if you hire people of color, there's an assumption that by having them, they have a perspective which is not shared by people who it might be Caucasian or mostly Caucasian. And that talks about values, doesn't it?
Human values do come into play in reporting, and you need to have diversity in order to get the full range of understanding that you don't have if you have a staff of all middle-aged white guys as reporters, which
you
is what it used to be.
You guys are so lucky that you have me on the show.
When I used to go out on stories as a reporter, I always valued having a photographer with me, and I made every effort to ask a photographer to come because I knew that there would be perspectives I would miss because it's impossible to include every possible question because each human has their own particular subjectivities. So the fact that I could have a photographer there, and I worked with many pros who were not afraid to interject their questions to a source that I might be interviewing, was invaluable. And so the more voices that are in a newsroom and the more subjectivities that are there contribute to a fuller understanding of the community they're serving.
I couldn't agree with you more.
Right. I think you're thinking that there is a perfect, that I'm advocating for a perfect, pure reporter that will bring all perspectives and be as fair and be able, and so that one, it would be a one size fit all. But I'm acknowledging your point that you need someone who grew up in the countryside. You need someone who grew up in the suburbs. You need someone with an Ivy League education. You need someone with no education.
And somebody, Judy, who is admitted into a community they may be covering. Rex has made this point many times on this show that if you have somebody of color and you're covering a community which has major minority population, that person is going to gain access in a way that a white reporter may not.
It helps us. I have a reporter now who's Arabic speaking, and that I think helps us in terms of reaching the Arabic speaking community, which is small in this area, but it is nevertheless here, and it gives us access to stories that we wouldn't otherwise get. That's just a practical matter, but it's also a matter of trust, and it's also a matter of getting a point of view from, in this case, a Muslim community that you want to have reflected in the paper. So there are values among journalists, and we do. It is true that we apply values in deciding what goes on the front page or what leads a newscast. I mean, surely, Alan, in your hiring of reporters, you're not saying that you alone don't have your values reflected in your hiring.
Well, first of all, I have to say that we have a strict firewall between the hiring of reporters here. Our news staff hires the reporters. I don't. So when you say you don't, you mean the institution. Is that what you mean?
No, I did not realize you had nothing to do with that.
Well, I may sit in on an interview, you know, at the end after a decision has been made. I always say, sure, whatever you want to the people who are doing the hiring.
So let's say Ian Pikus, your news director, he's value-free, unlike Judy and me doing our hiring.
My point is no one is value-free.
Okay, that we can agree on. That's true. That's true. But fortunately,
no one is value-free. The question is what you do with your values.
Yes. And in journalism, it's about justice seeking, right? So what people recognize in journalism is generally many injustices. I would say journalists are particularly sensitive to injustice, and that would be something that would influence the coverage that happens via journalism.
But not at the New York Post.
Well, they would say that they're seeking justice.
You're exactly right, Rex.
And so are the people at Fox News.
Which is why you're all a bunch of phonies.
But where would you be without it?
Here we go. It's the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Media@wamc.org is how you can join in the conversation. That's Alan Shartok, Kaylin Brown of the College of St. Rose, and Judy Patrick of the Daily Gazette, and I'm Rex Smith from the Times Union. Let's talk about the silliness of cable news, since none of us here reflect the cable news, and it's easy for us to pick on them, therefore. The dumbest controversy of the week, Columbia Journalism Review has said, was when Rick Santorum, He's a former Pennsylvania senator, a former candidate for president.
Very well spoken.
He is now a paid contributor to CNN. And his response to the gun control demonstrations was this. And this was meant to be like a conservative viewpoint. Santorum, of course, is against additional laws on guns. He says, how about kids, instead of looking to someone else to solve their problem, do something about maybe taking CPR classes or trying to deal with situations that where there is a violent shooter, you can actually respond to that?
Well, first of all, I saw Christopher Cuomo beat the hell out of Santorum.
Figuratively?
I mean, they're sitting next, he could have. They're sitting, right, very buff. They're sitting right next to each other. And Santorum, of course, is paid to be the conservative voice on CNN. A conservative voice on CNN, right? So there he is, and Cuomo is taking no prisoners. He just beats the heck out of him. And over this very remark about, you know, and Santorum is forced to say that he had misspoken.
But that didn't stop CNN from then airing this for 24 hours, from going with people denouncing Santorum. And so it made this commentary loop. This is how cable channels manage to fill 24 hours of airtime.
That and glass tables and having people sitting around, and the so-called panels, you know, each giving their perspective.
So the biggest takeaway from the Santorum comment that young people should learn CPR in an effort to take action against misuse of guns is an interesting observation, because I think that the individuals, the children or teenagers who are taking action, are taking a different kind of action, which, were Santorum in office, would result in hopefully him being voted out of office, because these kids are registering to vote and they are learning that that is the ultimate choice, and that if they register to vote, they will influence the public landscape.
That's right. You know, one of the things about Santorum that is so interesting is I keep wondering whether, when they hire a guy like that and give him this massive exposure, whether or not he has to tell them that he will not run for public office as a result of having been on that show. I'd really like to know the answer to that one.
Yeah. You wonder if he would keep that promise, though, even if he, I mean, politicians have often said this, I will serve out my full term, and then, well, I changed my mind, and they get out of it. So,
well, it could be like, Stormy Daniels, $1 million for every infraction.
Between
the Santorum fiasco, and it was an exceptionally bad week for cable talk shows. I thought the Stormy Daniels interview followed up. At one point, Jeffrey Toobin was sitting between the two lawyers, one for Stormy Daniels and one for Cohen, and it was ridiculous. It was beyond belief that this was taking up valuable airtime. There was no, one of them was saying thug, 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 and I'm thinking, I'm listening to Saturday morning cartoons more than discussion here.
Well, Judy, as an outstanding editor, which you are, and everybody knows it, still, there is that moment when an editor has to decide what people are going to read or not read or watch or not watch. And clearly, there is nothing about Stormy Daniels and there is nothing about any of the others that won't rise to the top of the pool.
The biggest audience for 60 Minutes in 10 years was the Anderson Cooper interview of Stormy Daniels. Was CBS wrong to do it?
My takeaway is that our president was depicted bending over to be swatted, that was her word, with a magazine. So that's the image of our president is forever emblazoned in my mind. Was it wrong for Anderson Cooper to conduct that interview? No. I think it's good for the American people to get her perspective on what she says happened and to recognize who we have running this country.
But you will admit that Stormy Daniels is huge news for the American population, which brought Penthouse and Playboy, and now gets more pornography on the web. It's the single greatest bringer in of money. And editors know that they won't be an editor for 3 days more if the competitor gets it, and they don't.
And it is interesting in that interview that they led with the magazine swatting episode. Mm-hmm. It was a fine interview, but they did go to the low base.
You know, the public policy issue there is the one that didn't get a lot of attention, of course, but that is the payment of hush money just before the election. That's why this is relevant. That's why it may end up being what drives a portion, at least, of the impeachment of Donald Trump that may well follow the election if there's a majority Democratic in the House. And that
That's
is the
exactly
payment
right.
of hush money, which could have been illegal, an illegal campaign contribution. So, but
I don't think that one's going to fly. I'll be honest with you. I don't think it's enough. I think it's going to have to be more, but I do think...
Oh, yeah,
think,
it'll be just a count.
I do think that if Stormy's, if I may call her that...
Stephanie?
Lawyer gets him before a deposition, and he lies, which he does all the time, in the deposition, which is why he's not saying much anymore right now about Stormy, because if he lies, not publicly, you can lie all you want, but if you lie to a jurist or to a court or to... You really, that is the kind of thing that got Bill Clinton into terrible, terrible trouble, and they know it.
And the Cooper interview also speaks to the values or lack thereof of the current sitting president. And the population who voted for him allegedly has a conservative value system, which would be at odds with what was revealed in that interview.
Well, you know, it does show, as Margaret Sullivan, our brilliant journalism writer for the Washington Post now and former Buffalo News editor, as she wrote, that the story really is about financial and emotional intimidation. And that's really what went on here. Now, I know that's not what the story is about in the context of why everybody watched. Everybody wanted to see what she really like, which was interesting.
Rex.
Sir.
I'm sorry. I'd never like to undermine your authority here as the boss of this program. But what about Ken Lovett? We have to talk about Ken Lovett. We only have 3 minutes.
You know, I was going to go from the ridiculous to the sublime, or to even, is it ridiculous? Ken Lovett, a veteran Daily News Albany bureau chief, a fine reporter, was handcuffed and taken into custody in the lobby of the state Senate because a Senate guard, these are patronage employees of the state Senate, observed him speaking on his cell phone in the lobby.
An empty lobby, by the way.
An empty lobby. The Senate was not in session. There are signs that say that phone calls are prohibited, but that is disregarded in the extreme. Everybody is using their cell phone when the Senate is in session or when they are not.
And they took him away in handcuffs.
It's kind of outrageous, isn't it?
You can look on YouTube and see video of people in that lobby several sessions ago, all on their cell phones. So whether that rule's in place then or not, that is what happens in that lobby. The lobbyists, legislative assistants are all on their cell phones waiting to get in and out of the chamber.
So what I have to know is who put the guard up to it? In other words, we know Speaker Hastie, who I sometimes, in the assembly, I sometimes call Boss Hastie because he was boss of the Bronx before that. Boss Hastie came right out and said, "This, we allow cell phones." And the governor came running over trying to grab some headlines, although by that time, Ken Lovett testifies that the guy who was in charge of the detail, as we call it, in the Senate had already told him upon apologize and said, you're out of here. But the governor came running over and tried to say, you know, because he and Lovett have a particularly testy relationship they have in the past.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating stuff. And everybody in Albany loved it. The whole thing went viral. Everybody's sick and tired of the damn budget.
Is it not,
doing.
Though, Alan, a great example of, Judy's sitting here not commenting. I'll bet she would say, this is silliness for us to spend time on it, right?
The Twitter went crazy yesterday after as this was happening, although I will concede that Andrew Cuomo did show he has a sense of humor. I was happy to see it. And then again, he did stop and answer some reporters' questions, and they have been trying to get him to answer questions for a bit, so I welcome that. But
was that after the woman beat him up in his press conference?
Verbally.
No, I think it was more than verbal.
Maybe what I saw was her yelling and having
maybe you're right.
An upsettedness situation there.
But were we silly? I mean, actually, we had a story the next day in the Times Union, a print story. Was that a bad judgment to do a story about this?
No.
I was horrified to see a picture of a reporter with his hands behind his back in handcuffs in the halls of our state capitol.
Overusing a cell phone.
But what we need is a follow-up story that finds out who was the person who cuffed Lovett.
Absolutely.
And what was the impetus for that person doing
that? You are so right. So, for example, the one guy we haven't really heard from, at least I haven't up to now, is, I was trying to make that point before, is Flanagan, the leader of the Senate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if it turned out, you're right, Caitlin, if it turns out that that's what happened, that there was the word is, you know, get him. Now, I don't have any evidence of that at all, but he was Flanagan was strangely silent.
All right, we will see. Stay tuned, folks. We will try to give you more about the poor cuffed reporter. The Media Project, Alan Shartok, Kaylin Brown, Judy Patrick, and Rex Smith. We thank you for joining us, and we hope to see you next week right here.
Policy is an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give free cheers for freedom of the press.